From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. New Hampshire saw somber reflections this week with the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, remembering those Granite Staters who were killed that day and honoring first responders. Here's Portsmouth Police Chief Stephen Du Bois.
We've always reflected upon the events that happened at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and I thought today, the theme that I wanted to talk about was ordinary people and the courage that they have, and in tough times that, people step up to help others.
In addition to 9/11, politics dominated New Hampshire news this week. Party nominees are settled and the general election season begins. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is attending a GOP unity breakfast this morning and spoke to a millennials group last night.
And I'm here tonight not because I'm young anymore, but because Evan said that we're worried about young people moving back in with their parents, and I've got three young kids, and I don't want them to move back in, all right? I love my kids, but I'm hoping they get a job. I'm hoping they move out and the basement is empty in my house.
In addition to political celebrities like Senator Paul, a business celebrity visited New Hampshire midweek. Newly reinstated Market Basket CEO Arthur T. Demoulas walked the aisles of the Londonderry store with Governor Hassan.
You know, the governor, like all of us here at Market Basket, you know, enjoys being amongst the people. And also enjoys serving the people, you know. And about 10 days ago, the governor and I, we spoke about meeting together and taking a tour of one of our stores here together.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We go now to that unity breakfast that I mentioned. The Republicans are pulling together and getting unified for the general election. NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers is at the breakfast. Josh, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
So some of these races, as you know, Josh, were pretty contested. So there's often a lot of speculation about a losing candidate not showing up, making a point that they might still be licking their wounds from the primary. So who's there and who isn't, Josh?
Pretty much everybody's here, as far as I can tell. All the major candidates in all the major races, Republicans up and down the totem pole at every level, several hundred people. Lots of it's a great day to be a Republican, and let's get unified to beat the Democrats in a few weeks.
So Bob Smith was a little upset during the primary. Jim Rubens, they're both there.
Oh, indeed, front and center.
Okay. Rand Paul is the speaker, Josh, the Kentucky U.S. Senator, and he was also at an event targeting young people last night. What are we hearing from Senator Paul?
Well, he's yet to take the stage. They've been toggling through the candidates who won the primaries on Tuesday, and so we're headed, the congressional candidates that spoke, Frank Kenton, Marilinda Garcia, Scott Brown, Walt Havenstein will be up, and then Senator Paul. Kelly Ayotte also spoke, and interestingly, she stressed the need that, you know, an obvious one perhaps, but the Republicans really need to do a better job on the ground mobilizing voters, and said, you know, we got beat by Democrats last time on the ground. We can't let that happen this year.
Yeah, that's interesting. Other themes, Josh, that have been jumping out from the breakfast. As you said, it's still underway, but what are some of the other themes that you're hearing from folks there at the Unity Breakfast?
Well, these are essentially pep rallies, so nothing terribly subtle. You know, we need to stop the president. We need to make sure that Harry Reid doesn't leave the Senate. And the specter of Nancy Pelosi returning as speaker was also raised. And, you know, the claim made by GOP Chairman Jennifer Warren was that the only accomplishment current Governor Maggie Hassan has is that she's raised your taxes. So, you know, this is red meat stuff for Republicans. But there's an eye towards the practical reality that you got winning elections is about getting voters to the polls, and that's something that's being stressed by every speaker.
Okay, Josh, thanks a lot for taking time out. We appreciate it.
No problem, Laura.
That's Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, again on the scene at the GOP Unity Breakfast this morning. The phone number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gary Reno is with us this week. He's State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
And joining us for a few moments is Michael Brinley. He's newscast producer and reporter for us here at NHPR. And Michael, thank you for being here as well.
No problem.
Well, and Michael, you were busy covering the primary elections this week and now the general elections kicking into gear. Just step back for a moment, Michael. Just what jumps out from these Republican primary results that we saw on Tuesday night?
Well, I think no real big surprises. I think maybe the biggest surprise was how badly Marylinda Garcia defeated Gary Lambert. I think a lot of people thought that was going to be closer, but that ended up being the biggest blowout of the night. And that's, looking ahead a little bit, I'm sure that's got Annie Custer, got her attention. So moving forward, that might be one of the more contested races moving forward. So, not a lot of surprises. Scott Brown winning. You see Jim Rubens and Bob Smith essentially equal at the end of the day. So, moving forward, we'll see what happens.
Well, and that was something that was noted by a couple people, Dean, that, it wasn't, the victories were pretty much expected, but the margins were big. They were impressive, as Michael said.
Yeah, and I agree with Michael. I don't think there were any great surprises here. What's so interesting to me about these results is, the conventional wisdom on political primaries is that they're all about, ideological purity, motivating the base to turn out, focusing on core principles and choosing your nominee, et cetera, and then you kind of tack to the center and have a more general strategic debate there in the general election. I think what these results show is that something I've argued before is that it's probably more about electability. I think people look at the field and they try to figure out which candidate is most likely to beat the incumbent from the other party or the challenger from the other party if it's an open seat. And that's the primary criteria. Are they likable? Can they raise money? Do they look like they have an organization that will be viable in a general election? And I think, I think we saw very clearly that in each of the races, that trumped this sort of these core arguments. We heard it from Jim Rubens. We heard it from Bob Smith. We heard it from Andrew Hemingway, these sort of core arguments about principles and conservative ideals. I think that's part of it. But in the end, I think it's really about electability. So for me, doing that calculus, I think that these margins are very, very much what I expected.
Yeah. And talking about margins, to you, Gary Reno, the one race that was a little closer was in the first congressional district, where you had Dan Innes offering a solid challenge to former Congressman Frank Ginta. Just remind us what happened there, Gary.
Well, it was a fairly close election. I think a lot of people didn't think it was going to be quite as close.
It's like 8 or 9 percentage points.
I mean, it still was a pretty good victory for Ginta. But what I think is sort of important about that election more than anything is we have a new star on the horizon, in Dan Innes. The Republican Party over the last few years has a little bit of a trouble with the young star quality. They haven't really had a lot of them. And here we have a guy who's obviously going to be around for a while. He's was attractive. His candidacy was a little slow to get going, but once it got going toward the end, he really did well, and he was closing in on Frank Ginta.
So. Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say also, biggest surprise for me was how well Jim Lawrence did. I mean, 19%. I think a lot of people saw him as that third candidate who was
this
there
in the second congressional district.
In the second CD. I mean, 19%. He was almost up with Gary Lambert. So, I mean, I think he did a great job in the debate on MUR, and I think maybe that played into the results a little bit. He got into the race late. I don't think he had really a lot of ad campaign, but I mean, to get 19%, I think to me was impressive, more than I expected from him.
Right. He did get in late and didn't have tons of money. And so what I'm hearing from you and Gary, Michael, is, even those people who don't win, you become part of the bench. And there's always an election in New Hampshire, right? I mean,
Every 2 years.
Yeah. What do you think, Dean?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm someone who believes that we tend to overemphasize the impact of debates. But I do think in Jim Lawrence's case, you know, he was not highly visible. He had that one ad buy that was just a few thousand dollars, didn't have high name recognition. For people who were kind of put off by the bickering between Lambert and Garcia, he seemed like a very viable option. And it's clear he's interested in running, just as I think Dan Innes is. And, you know, the Innes Ginter rate, I think, was like 49, 41. He said he's going to be back again. It's just a question of, you know, which race and when. So, yeah, it's a good sign for, you know, Republicans have really struggled to find quality candidates. It's one of the reasons why they pushed so hard to bring Scott Brown in to go up against Gene Shaheen. So it's got to give them some hope that, you know, maybe there is a replenishing of the bench after the 2012 Democratic victories.
Well, and for the last couple weeks, it's been mostly a Republican message out there, because these primaries were about finding Republican candidates, getting those nominees set. But Michael Brindley, now that the primary is over, we're hearing from Democrats again here in the Granite State. What's the message from them?
You know, basically that they've got the job done and they're going to keep it going, and they need to keep, you know, New Hampshire going that way. So, I mean, you saw Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan out there on primary night, not wasting any time. Gene Shaheen, I think, of all of them, was out ahead of it. You know, she's been, even before the primary, running ads, and I think she's really, you know, this is going to be a big battle for her. You know, you've already seen, like we said, Maggie Hassan the next morning at Market Basket. I'm sure that was not a coincidence with Arthur T. Demoulas touring Market Basket in Londonderry. I'm sure that was something that she was planning to do. And also, I think today we have Annie Custer out there with an endorsement from a seniors group. So they're out there. They're going to start, you know, hearing more from them.
Yeah, Gary.
I think, well, even election night when people were giving their victory speeches, I mean, it was the engagement was beginning. Let's start right now, and we're going to come out hard and we're going to come out aggressive. And I mean, it didn't take long. They were talking. Annie Custer was talking about Mary Linda Garcia as being like the Tea Party candidate, and it was just all this rhetoric already starting, and so it was like no time to rest. Let's get right to it and let's go.
Yeah, quick thoughts, Dean?
Yeah, you know, I think just as Gary said, just from election night, the Democratic message was very clear. They're going to say, you know, we're delivering results. All these Republican candidates are Tea Party extremists. They're going to deny you a living wage. They're going to give tax breaks to the wealthy and big corporations like the oil companies. And if you're a woman, they're going to take away your birth control. I think those are the kinds of themes that we're going to hear. And they hit the ground running on election eve.
All right.
And then the Republicans are all tying everybody to
Obama.
Right.
Okay. Michael Brindley, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Michael Brindley. He's NHPR's newscast producer and reporter who's been covering elections for us here at NHPR. Coming up, we'll talk with NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown about some controversy over Common Core in Manchester. Also, a couple more elections questions for our guests, including the influence of money in this year's races. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In a couple minutes, we'll turn to the Queen City of Manchester, which, during this back-to-school season, is giving poor grades to the Common Core education standards being put in place now by many districts. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, a few more political stories stemming from this week's primary and the general elections really kicking off. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, a few more questions that have come out of the elections. One, Dean, is money. Now, we did see the influence of outside groups somewhat in the primaries, but what's the forecast for the general elections in terms of outside money? You know, nobody knows how much, but what kind of money, which candidates may get the most, and so forth.
Yes, the forecast is lots and lots of money from everywhere. I'll tell you a funny story. Back in the late 90s, I co-wrote an article with two of my colleagues up at Dartmouth, and we looked at this issue of the impact of outside spending in New Hampshire. And at the time, we argued it was very difficult for outside money to get a foothold for a variety of reasons, dealing with kind of the nature of the state and retail politics and the media markets, et cetera. That's no longer the case. You know, we've had a number, these sort of Supreme Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United have really changed that. These outside groups are bringing tremendous money. I came across an interesting statistic. It said that so far on the Brown-Shaheen race, $19 million has been spent, which is a tremendous amount of money. $9.9 million of that has been from outside groups, which is over half the amount of money. So this is only the beginning. Both sides are doing it. The biggest danger here is campaigns lose control of the message. You have these outside groups throwing all kinds of stuff up on TV. They're not you can't really figure out who's behind it. A lot of them, it's a risk because sometimes these messages are helpful. They soften up the opponents with these negative ads. Other times they create unnecessary complications for the candidate who's ostensibly being helped by the ad. So we're gonna see a lot of money, I think, at all levels. I think the Shaheen Brown race is going to bring in a lot of national money. Also, probably the Garcia Custer race is going to bring in a lot of outside money now that Garcia looks like a viable opponent for Annie Custer. So it's just going to keep getting more and more.
Yeah, so a rainy forecast. I'm not sure how to use that weather analogy. Yeah. But a question for you, Dean, and then Gary, I want to hear from you too. So you talked about the dangers of outside money is that a candidate loses control of the message. And
right.
I think everybody understands what you're saying there. But I wonder, given how big these sums are, does that danger really outweigh the benefits? I mean, candidates benefit tremendously from all this money. They could never raise this much on their own.
Sure, they can't raise as much on their own. There are certainly examples where it helps to soften up the opponent. It raises the name visibility often of the individual who's ostensibly being helped. You know, I'm a believer that at some point you reach a saturation where none of this stuff matters. And I noticed just over the weekend and last week, just spend an hour watching evening news, local and national news. It's nothing. It was nothing but political ads. And we have about 7 more weeks to the general, and every available slot is going to be filled. Not only MUR, but you're going to see it coming in on the Boston stations on cable. So, I'm on balance. I think some of it doesn't matter. I think some of it actually hurts the candidates because they lose control of the message. But, yes, it does also help them as well because typically candidates raise a fraction of what is spent on the race overall now.
Gary.
And I think, too, if we go back 2 elections, I mean, the U.S. Senate race between Kelly Ayotte and Paul Hodes, I mean, that was the most expensive race in state history. 2 years later, we have the governor's race, which was the most expensive race in state history. And this year, we're probably going to have 2 people or 2 races that break that, the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. I mean, the money that's just pouring in here is phenomenal.
Although, Gary, one of the messages from the last election, 2012, was that big money wasn't necessarily the big winner. You remember that narrative from the last time around. So how thoughtful do you think these groups are going to be, Gary, about spending money that makes a difference at the polls?
Oh, I think they're not going to just spend money to spend money. They're going to spend it very targeted, in a targeted way. I mean, and you can spend it poorly, like if you remember the Republican Governors Association 2 years ago went after Governor Hassan over her property taxes. Well, she lives at Phillips Exeter Academy, so she's not going to be paying property taxes. That one kind of blew up in their face.
And
things like that sometimes happen, and that's what Dean was talking about.
I think sometimes these organizations try to get guidance from individuals or organizations within the state, but occasionally you just see these clunkers that really the ads bear no resemblance to kind of what's going on on the ground in the state, and that's problematic for whichever candidate it's supposed to help. Like that governor's ad is a great example.
Again, the number for you to join us here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email us your questions, comments, thoughts about some of the news of the week that we're looking at this hour. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And gentlemen, it's back to school season, and Sam Evans Brown is with us, NHPR's education reporter. Sam, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So you and I have sat down many times and talked about the Common Core, and in a minute I want to find out what's happening with Common Core in our biggest city, Manchester. But just remind us very briefly, Sam, what Common Core is, why we're hearing so much about it lately.
So the Common Core is a series of sort of educational benchmarks. It's basically saying that each student, as they graduate or as they move on from each year, should be able to do certain things in math and in English and language arts. They, you know, in math, for instance, they should know how to, you know, how to use fractions in a certain way by the time they graduate fourth grade. And in English, they should be able to deconstruct a, you know, an argument by the time they leave sixth grade, things like that.
And why are we hearing so much about it, Sam, in Manchester? What's the controversy in Manchester about?
So Manchester, in a lot of ways, it has been targeted by activist groups. It's the largest school district in the state. And so that's where the folks who are most concerned about Common Core have sort of focused their efforts. And also sort of geographically, that's where they happen to be. Some of them happen to be located in sort of the surrounding towns around Manchester. And so they come in and they their voice can be heard there because there's a newspaper that is actually covering the Board of School meetings. And so it's a good target for them. It's a way to have sort of their arguments on the stage. And because of that, there's been pushback against the Common Core in Manchester for a long time. This sort of came to a head last fall. There was this meeting in which the Commissioner of Education came down and was sort of confronted these folks. And she said that she would help schools get or at least it was interpreted that she was saying she would help schools get a waiver from tests. So
the smarter balanced tests, which we've joked about sounds like a butter substitute,
right.
But go ahead.
Yeah, so the smarter balanced is a test. It's based on the Common Core. It's what's called aligned to the standards. So if you're teaching kids using the standards, it'll be the test that you take, and it makes a lot of sense. However, if you're trying to get out from under the standards and you still have to take the test, it's a big hurdle.
It doesn't match up, does
right,
it?
Right, exactly. If you were to use different standards, you'd still have to take the test, and so you'd still have to teach the standards, basically. And so Manchester had been operating under this assumption that it would be able to get out from under the smarter balance, but the State Department of Education sent them a letter saying, actually, no. If you don't take the Smarter Balance test, you are going to be at risk of forfeiting all the federal dollars that go to you. It's around $17 million that flow just to the Manchester School District.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, and so it would be crazy for them to do that. And then this week, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatz has fired back with a letter saying that, you know, he never realized that these strings were attached. If he had known, he never would have signed on, and just basically expressing his disappointment.
Gary, go ahead, jump in.
Nashville explored this before Manchester did, and they found out literally that, you know, by federal and state law, you really do have to have a statewide test. And when you start opting out, then you start going up against this problem. The other problem is when the state got the waiver from the No Child Left Behind, there were certain assurances that they made the federal government. One of them was that they would be statewide testing that would be accountable. And this is exactly what it was all about. And now to step back and say, we're going to say maybe you don't have to do this, Manchester, because you have a high population of minority students and second language students, isn't what the federal waiver grant was about. And it's also not about what the state and federal law says.
Wow, that's interesting. So it's good to get that history in there, Gary, that we as a state promised to do X if the feds would give us a waiver from No Child Left Behind. And now if we let Manchester duck out, we're not fulfilling our promise on that end. Okay, yeah, Sam.
And it should be made clear that waiver, in getting that waiver, that whole process was this long, drawn-out negotiation between the state and the federal government. And the federal government is very concerned about accountability. They want to be sure that schools are being tested in a way so that parents can see how schools are performing. And so the idea that you could have schools, you know, all across the state all doing different tests is something that's sort of anathema to that entire philosophy.
So what happens next? If I've got a kid in Manchester schools, what can I expect for him or her?
They're going to take the Smarter Balance test spring. Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Everyone in the state is going to take it. It's going to be a very different test. We haven't seen its complete version yet. It's going to, you know, in the lower grades, it's about 7 hours of testing. In the upper grades, it's about 8 hours of testing. And it's going to be computer-based, which has been a big issue for the schools. A lot of them have been upgrading their computers in order to be able to take their tests, their computers and their bandwidth, because it's online. So it's a big deal.
Wow, so that's a big infrastructure upgrade that they have to do before they can even take the test.
Yep, and that's been a whole subject by itself that we could talk about for an hour. but basically, you know, some schools have had it easier than others in doing that upgrade.
Okay, Sam, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
That's Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's education and environment reporter, updating us on the Common Core, the Smarter Balance Test, and controversy over that in Manchester. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. And Gary Raynor, Dean Spiliotis, let's go to our listeners now. And John's calling from Concord. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Good morning to all.
Morning, John.
A twofold question. Back to the electability and campaigning. How much of the campaign contributions, to quote one of the panelists, the money that pours in, how much of that is trackable? And secondly, how much does it really determine the agenda or the true agenda of the candidate?
Great questions, John. Thanks. And Gary, to you first, how much is trackable? I think there's a number of organizations that do a very good job tracking this stuff.
There are. And law now requires like television stations to put up what they take in from which groups for the advertising. The issue of trackability also goes to this dark money issue, is it so-called, which is there are organizations that are set up as educational organizations, if you will. And they don't have to disclose their donors. So groups like Crossroads, from Karl Rove. Is one of these organizations. So you don't know who's donating to it. Americans for Prosperity has an arm like that. You don't know who's donating to it.
So you know it's AFP or Crossroads, but
you don't
know that, you know, it's...
Who's the money behind it? You
know? I see. Yeah, and his other questions, also a very good one, Dean Spiliotis. How much does this money set the agenda?
It's a good question. You know, I was sort of suggesting in my earlier comments that, you know, it's kind of useful for perhaps softening up the opponents and maybe getting a little more name recognition out there for the candidates. You know, whether or not it actually sets the agenda is a little harder to say. I think there are a lot of things that go into determining, you know, what the agenda is going to be. The media plays a big role in that, the kinds of stories they decide to cover. You know, the candidates themselves, what they're talking about. But it is true if you have this kind of convergence of these outside groups on particular issues, at a minimum, it forces the candidates to deal with them. You know, whether or not it actually sets the agenda, I'm not sure.
Well, it seems like a certain group wouldn't donate to Dean Spiliotis' campaign or Gary Raynor's campaign unless they were already kind of lined up with your agenda, so to speak, Dean, right?
Right. Yeah, and it is. I think Gary did a nice job of describing the kind of tricky balance here because, you know, a lot of these groups consider themselves, quote, advocacy groups where they, you know, they'll talk about an issue or kind of dance around the fact that they're actually going after a particular candidate just in order to skirt these disclosure laws.
All right. Well, John, it's a great question. Thank you for calling in. The number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. This week, gentlemen, President Obama spoke to the nation about his plan for airstrikes against the Islamic militant group that calls itself Islamic State. Now, on the Friday News Roundup on Diane Rehm, I'm sure they'll be talking more about this. But in terms of New Hampshire, Gary Raynor, how have Granite State politicians and now the candidates running for those federal offices reacted to President Obama's speech?
Well, I think everybody's quite aware that people generally have been kind of war weary with all the fighting that's been going on in Afghanistan and Iraq before that. But I think with ISIS, people are realizing this is a real danger here. And with 100, 150 people holding American passports or American citizens being trained by this group with the opportunity to come back and have the terrorists within, if you will, is a real, real danger here. And so I don't think anybody is saying we don't think this is a good idea or whatever. You know, the president went out and said we're going to do more airstrikes. We're going to be training these people. We're going to be giving them equipment, and but we're not putting boots on the ground. And basically, I think everybody in the congressional delegation was basically saying that's all right. That's the way we want. But Kelly Ayotte was sort of saying we really need to do more. That we ought to be doing, we really ought to have special forces and people like that there.
When you dig into these statements that the delegation put out in the candidates, Dean, what do you see?
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of general agreement that there needs to be some kind of coordinated response. But, you know, different politicians are kind of focused on different aspects of it. So, you know, for example, you know, Jean Shaheen said that President Obama's speech was a good start, but she's really concerned about how we're going to deal with Syria. You know, are we going to aid moderate rebel factions in Syria? Are we going to have airstrikes across the Syrian border, which we have not done yet? In contrast, you know, Kelly Ayotte, who's been pushing for airstrikes for a while, is concerned, as Gary mentioned, about the immigration and passport issues and people getting in from outside of the country to have domestic terrorism here. You know, the big debate is you know, sort of how comprehensive this should be, whether it involves putting troops back into Iraq. I think most people have sort of been opposed to that because of sort of the public opinion data shows people want something, but they're still very cautious about putting troops in. I think Scott Brown said he would keep all options open, and he's one of the few people to actually say that. You know, I think there are real divisions in the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party about kind of just how much to kind of recommit ourselves to dealing with this problem.
But they all seem to be very leery of not going along with whatever the president wants to do. I mean, because they're afraid of the pushback on that, I think, at this point.
One more story quickly that I wanted to get to you, with, gentlemen, is two cases of triple E. The Department of Health and Human Services, Gary, announced a second case this week, an adult from Hopkinton. The first case was in late August in the Conway area. Why is triple E so concerning, Gary, more so that it's said than West Nile?
Well, yeah, I mean, triple E has the potential to be very harmful. Creates all kinds of health problems, particularly when you have inflammation of the brain, which is one of the things that you have with this. I mean, you can have some permanent damage, if not fatal illness. So, I mean, it's a very serious disease, and you know, it's mosquito-borne disease. And so, it's as we know in New Hampshire, mosquitoes are here until we get the first frost. So, it's fairly prevalent, and it has the ability to, as mosquitoes do, to travel in fairly large areas. So, Hopkinton, Concord, Conway. I mean, these are key areas in the state that could have a significant impact if it really have a lot of it spreading around.
All right. Well, coming up in just a moment on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, we'll talk about the opening of a brand new television service called NH1 that was announced this week. Also, one of you mentioned earlier Market Basket, Governor Hassan, and Arthur T. Demoulas cruise the aisles of a Londonderry Market Basket store. We'll find out more in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Let's turn now to a story that we followed closely all summer, and that's Market Basket. A few weeks ago, this long fight was resolved, and Arthur T. Demoulas was reinstated as CEO of the supermarket chain. And then this week, RDT, as he's called, came to New Hampshire. Dean Spiliotis, how come?
Mm-hmm. He's doing a little bit of a victory tour, going to different visiting different Market Basket stores in the region to kind of thank employees. And I guess some people knew that he was going to show up at this Londonderry Market Basket, although he surprised a lot of others. And it was just a sort of big love fest with both employees and customers kind of encircling him. Governor Hassan was along with him for the ride, and he praised her for her help in negotiating. You know, both she and Governor Deval Patrick from Massachusetts had been involved in trying to bring the opposing sides together. So he had some very kind words for her. It was great political optics for the Hassan campaign to have the two of them seeming so very comfortable together, walking around the store, smiling and shaking hands. So good for her, and you know, good for the Market Basket employees as well to see RDT.
Well, did Mr. Demoulas, Dean, have anything else to say beyond yay, New Hampshire, and thank you, New Hampshire, and thank you, Governor Hassan?
Well, he talked. He's considering. I think he said there's something like 21 Market Baskets or 28 Market Baskets in New Hampshire, and they're looking to open additional ones, which got people kind of excited. And so, you know, Governor Hassan was able to kind of piggyback on that, talking about creating jobs and a good business climate in New Hampshire.
Gary?
You talk about the power of the incumbency here. You know, I mean, can't you see the ads coming with Governor Hassan and RDT walking the aisles of Market Basket? I mean, who's not going to like Governor Hassan and all this whole association with this? It's going to be great for her.
Well, speaking of political optics, New Hampshire politicians will have another place to present some political optics. At a time of shrinking traditional media, Gary, the opening of a brand new television service called NH1 was announced this week. You're a veteran of New Hampshire media, Gary. What does this add to the scene here?
Well, it certainly adds another very loud voice to particularly the broadcast media. Channel 9 has largely had the whole state to itself and has reaped the benefits of that in particularly political advertising and every 2 years they take a wonderful amount of money in from all these politicians. And I think Bill Binney, who started this empire, has the idea that maybe he should have a little of that too. But, I mean, in order to do that, he's gone out and he's put together a fairly impressive team of reporters and various other news people involved. And he's intending to make it a real battle between him and Channel 9.
Yeah, and NH1 is based here in Concord.
At the old Walker School, which he really has revamped entirely pretty much. And it's, from what I understand, it's a beautiful facility.
Well, Dean, you and I have a connection to this in that both our children went to
Walker School
for a couple years. What are your thoughts about Mr. Binney sort of making a fortune in business? He ran for U.S. Senate in 2010 in the Republican primary, didn't win. And then after that experience, he said, okay, I'm going to go into media now.
Yeah, well, I think he all along has had a desire to be a political player in the state, whether it's through elective office or some other means. A great way to be involved is kind of through political media. So, you know, I mean, they've said they're going to be focused on New Hampshire coverage, although they are probably also looking as well at kind of the Massachusetts media markets and the suburbs of Boston. You know, it's an opportunity for him to have a very nice high-tech platform to be involved in politics in the state, if not personally, then sort of indirectly through his team of reporters and whatever other types of programming they decide to do. And, you know, this I'm interested to see this building. I think they bought it for about $900,000, and they won't say how much they put into it except to say that it was a lot.
It's about 100 years old.
I think it was like 1905 or 1902. They did apparently preserve a door that a lot of the teachers had signed the back of the door, so they kept that intact. But, you know, he's been talking about doing this for a long time. You know, he had that station down in Derry that he renamed WBIN, but they closed that down a little while ago. And so, you know, he's got a dozen radio stations in New Hampshire. Now, he's serious about doing this. And as Gary said, he's lining up a nice group of talent to kind of kick it off. It's going to take a while. I mean, MUR has been around for decades and decades and is sort of well known in the state as a big political player. But there, as we know, there's certainly going to be enough campaign ads to go around if he's interested in running a few, making some money off of campaign ads.
And what's kind of interesting about what he's doing is the reporters and the news people are supposedly going across the entire spectrum from the television to the radio,
because he owns
a number of radio stations. So one reporter will be able to feed news to the television station, radio stations, and also they've got a website going up and blogs and so on. So a reporter isn't just doing something for the TV or just for the radio. It's going to be used across all platforms.
Well, and as we talk about reporters, we should note that our colleague Kevin Landrigan was hired there just days after the Nashua Telegraph announced the closure of its Statehouse Bureau. Kevin, of course, had covered the Statehouse for the Telegraph for many, many years. He's considered one of the finest, most knowledgeable reporters in the state. So that's a huge asset for NH1.
He's going to be your chief political correspondent, so he's going to be right in the middle of everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, the number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Gentlemen, a couple emails have come in on our political conversation that we had earlier. Here's Richard in Manchester who says, "Help me to understand how you call Garcia's win lopsided. Lambert, who self-destructed, and Lawrence, who had little name recognition, combined for 45% of the vote, which means that nearly half of the GOP voters in the moderate district voted against Garcia. Richard says 60% is lopsided, 70% is a rout, But if I were in Garcia's camp, I would be concerned. So there's Richard Dean Spiliotis with another way of looking at the numbers. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, and I didn't use the word lopsided. I don't think the results were particularly lopsided. You know, I think that all the winning Republican candidates were right around, with the exception of Walt Havenstein, who was at 55%. These other candidates were all 49, 50%. That is good in a multi-field race. But I think, as Richard mentions, this sort of, when you add up, you know, you could take Scott Brown and add up Jim Rubens and Bob Smith, and they come pretty close to Scott Brown. You know, that's indicative of deeper splits within the party between the sort of core conservative activists and kind of more establishment types who have a very different views about how to what types of candidates should be fielded. So, you know, I think these were all good victories. You know, I wouldn't really call any of them lopsided. But in a multi-field race, a multi-candidate field, to get 49 or 50% of the vote is pretty good.
Here's another email from Susan. I'll throw this to you, Gary Reno. She says, a point about the New Hampshire primary. Who is responsible for cleaning up the political signage? Who pays for the removal of it all? Susan, I want to let you know this question comes up every 2 years, so thank you.
The campaigns are supposed to clean up their signs.
Supposed to.
They're supposed to. But you can tell the ones that really have the money left after the race and the ones that don't, because the ones that have the money left, they do go out usually and clean up their signs, because if you're going to run again and you've left your signs out there, it leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths.
Sure.
So, but, I mean, a lot of the campaigns just don't, you know, and what it ends up usually is that the town road crews or city road crews end up taking a lot of these signs out.
Well, you don't want them getting stuck in your snowplows
come
sure December. But and some of the signs will stay up, just to answer Susan's question, because, you know, Marilinda Garcia, for example, Scott Brown, I mean, they'll keep their signs up because they're still in the running.
There's no reason to take them down at this point. No.
Okay. Susan, thanks for the question. It's a good one. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. Dean Spiliotis, a free speech case was closed this week when charges were dropped against Michael Zona, better known as the Chicken Man. Now, what did Mr. Zona do in the first place that got him into trouble?
Well, he dressed up in a chicken suit and followed Jean Shaheen around, asking her why she hadn't had a town hall meeting in, they claim, 2 years. I think they're saying she's chicken to have town hall meetings and talk directly to the public. You know, dressing up in costumes and confronting candidates has a long tradition. The chicken suit goes back at least to 1992 when George H.W. Bush was kind of hesitating on agreeing to debate with Bill Clinton, and a guy dressed in a chicken suit would go wherever President Bush was with a sign about something else, and then he would flip the sign over and it would say, "Chicken George won't debate." And then in 2000, we had the son of Chicken George, because George W. Bush skipped the Dartmouth debate among the Republican candidates. So there was another guy with a son of Chicken George saying, George W. won't debate. My personal favorite in the 2000 primary, Bill Bradley in Iowa, opposed ethanol subsidies, and a guy dressed as a giant stalk of corn followed him all around. They called him Ethanol Man. Everywhere Bill Bradley went was this guy in a giant corn stalk uniform. So, yes, it was a free speech case. The individual, Michael Zona, he's 23 years old. He's a GOP staffer. Said it was, you know, it's free speech for him to follow around and say, how come you're not having town hall meetings? And so charges were dropped.
Charges were dropped. Well, and some Democrats have said, Gary Reno, that, you know, Shaheen and other elected officials may be avoiding town halls because they've turned into open opportunities for harassment. Have you heard this complaint?
Oh, we've heard it for a while. I mean, back when, before the 2010 election, for example, when somebody like Carol Shea Porter would hold an event, I mean, there would be this, the quote-unquote Tea Party people would show up and drown her out and shout questions all over the place. And I think a lot of them don't want to see that happen again, because it really – in a couple of cases, it got a little bit dangerous, and some people felt threatened. And that's the history of it, I think. And I think a lot of the Democrats or even incumbents, period, have a little bit of a problem with some of that.
All right. Well, there you have. You've got the latest right here in the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup about the Chicken Man. And I didn't know about Ethanol Man, Dean.
Oh, so I have a picture. One of my favorites.
You learn something new every day. Another business story, Gary Reno. The Route 93 visitor centers and giant liquor stores are in various stages of getting ready to open up. There was a big grand opening yesterday of one of the liquor stores. Just give us the bigger picture, though, Gary. This is a huge project. What's the thinking behind this?
Well, I mean, a lot of us travel around, and we know in other states that they have these sort of facilities off the interstate where you can have a restaurant and you know, some places to buy goods and so on and things like that.
You walk your dog and all kinds of things. Go to the restroom, buy a drink.
In New Hampshire, we had the liquor store, some vending machines, a place to go to the bathroom, and
that's it.
Lottery tickets.
Yeah.
And that's what we had. And so for a number of years, the state has tried to interest somebody in going into the rest, particularly the Hooksett rest stops off 91.3 and doing that sort of development. And a couple of years ago, they thought they had something lined up, and that fell through. Well, then last year, Alex Ray, who owns the Common Man restaurant chain, got into agreement with the state to develop these sites. And so now we have these what will be very nice facilities off of 93 northbound and southbound, including, of course, liquor stores, which is what the state is using to make most of the – I mean, these liquor stores off the interstates just make tons and tons of money for the Liquor Commission. So those are going to be the – we're going to have a sort of mini mall with a liquor store as an anchor, as the main anchor. And
but other stuff to buy, other stuff to
do. Restaurants and all sorts of other things. And it's a $36 million project.
Yeah, it's big.
And they're actually ahead of schedule. And one of them is going to be opening soon and the other one by the end of the year.
And, Dean, from what I read, I think it was in the Concord Monitor, the northbound stop will be sort of welcome to New Hampshire. Here's all the cool stuff you can do and see. The southbound stop will be, if you liked it here,
yeah,
why don't you move here? Why don't you set up a business here? So it's more than just selling liquor and making money.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to boost tourism and economic development in the state. You know, it's given what the old ones were like, and if you see what's going up now, it really is quite amazing. The gas pumps are going to be useful for a lot of people as well. I'd be interested to know why the one side is going to be done sooner than the other, just out of sort of construction business curiosity. What drives that? But the northbound, the liquor store is open. Most of the other stuff's – a lot of the other stuff's going to be open in about 10 days. They said the southbound is going to be a little bit longer, but certainly by the end of the year. So it's been remarkable how efficient this entire process has been. These kinds of facilities can put you sort of in the right frame of mind when you're entering or leaving a state. So it'll be a lot of tax-free shopping, I'm sure, which will be popular.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nice to have a place to gas up and go to the bathroom and get something to eat and then get on your way.
Particularly when we've closed a lot of the rest areas over the years. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, gentlemen, next week on The Exchange, a couple shows I'm looking forward to. As we talk about, by the way, going up and down 993, we're going to take a look at New Hampshire's commuting culture, the economic, personal, and community impact of all those New Hampshire people who work in Massachusetts every day, an estimated 83,000 people. So there's an economic impact to that. There's also a community impact, the idea that, you know, if you're commuting all the way down to Boston, maybe you don't have time to, you know, coach a softball team or sit on the planning board. Maybe your work-life balance is out of whack because you spend so much time commuting. So we're going to take a look at that. People can post their Bay State commuting stories on our Facebook page, too, NHPR Exchange, and we'll use those to help shape our show. That's just one of the shows that we're up to next week. How about you, Gary Reno? What are you going to be following next week?
Well, believe it or not, the legislature is back in session next week.
Really? I did not know that.
Monday, the Senate will be in to take up the veto, one veto that the Governor Hassan did of the Senate bill, which has to do with the youth detention center and various aspects of that. And the House is in on Wednesday, and they'll be taking up the three bills that the Governor vetoed from the House. And usually in most instances, the Senate and the House are in together. And they go back and forth, but this will be a lot different because we'll see how it all works out. If the Senate overrides the bill that they have, overrides the veto, then it goes to the House. Well, the House can take it up Wednesday. But if the House overrides the three bills that she vetoed from the House, I don't know what's the Senate going to do. They're not going to be in session. So all sorts
of
fun
tricky,
stuff.
Oh, that's tricky, isn't it, Gary?
Yeah, it's got lots of politics going on here.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the emphasis on juvenile justice. We're going to do a show actually on Monday, shifting views, shifting policies about juvenile justice, both here in New Hampshire and around the country. Dean, how about you? What are you going to be following
next
week?
I'll be keeping one eye on those vetoes. You know, we talked about the legislation here earlier, so it'll be interesting to see what happens on the other end. So I'll certainly be watching that, but it really is the political season. And what will be so interesting for me is a lot of the candidates are going to – a lot of the national candidates, potential presidential candidates for 16, are going to be coming in. You know, we're going to see Ted Cruz coming back from Marilinda Garcia. We'll probably see Rand Paul stumping with candidates. Chris Christie will probably be back with Walt Havenstein and others. So it's an opportunity not only to watch these races that are important to the state, but to kind of see how the potential presidential candidates interact on the ground to provide support, also to raise their own name recognition and organization in the state.
So some people love the holiday season, Dean. For you,
this is
it right now.
That's right. 7 weeks.
Thank you for being here, Dean. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Gary Reno, great to see you. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.